nonprofits?
I don't know. What are the odds that out of the 6.5 billion people scattered over the face of the earth, two guys named Dennis Lube and Matt Dillahunty would be hosts of an internet show, along with their producer, Russell Glasser?
Hello!
On the 2nd of June, 2007, and that it would be broadcast from the Dillahunty International Studios in Austin, Texas, of all places. What are the chances that the intro music would be Viento del Arena by the Gypsy Kings? And what's the likelihood that all this would be sponsored by a non-profit educational organization called the Atheist Community of Austin that promotes not only positive atheism, but also the separation of church and state? Sound far-fetched yet? Consider the fact that the show just happens to be broadcast live every other Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3:30, and that a specific few will even participate in the live broadcast by just chancing to visit the nonprofits page at www.nonprofitsradio.com and logging into the chat room according to the instructions found there. Think about it. Dennis Lube alone is the result of an unbroken chain of successful ancestral reproduction going back 4.5 billion years to the first replicating molecule. And that's just me. Matt and Russell's ancestors all did the same thing. For 4.5 billion years, they all managed to avoid being eaten by that saber-tooth, or stepped on by that apatosaurus, or asphyxiating when they crawled out of that slime before they successfully produced young. Our ancestors couldn't make a single mistake for 4.5 billion years. 3 times! The odds against this are astronomical, and that's not even taking into account our listeners. All of them are the result of the same unlikely 4 billion year chain of events. It's freaking impossible, and I'm not even addressing the issues of the atoms necessary for all this being in place after having been forged in the hearts of exploding stars billions of years ago from hydrogen condensed from the fireball of a Big Bang. And now wrap your brain around this kicker. The Atheist Community of Austin has a happy hour! It's at the Dog and Duck on Thursday nights at 7:30. There's no way this is chance. The fact that we're here talking to you now is essentially impossible. The odds against this being the exact state of the universe is far too great, and there's only one conclusion that can be reached. The universe was designed for the non-profits. Welcome to the purpose of the universe.
Amen.
Hallelujah.
And there was much rejoicing. Holy cow.
I love that.
See, and I thought last week's intro was the best. I still think it might have a slight edge, but that was awesome.
Yeah, well, this one went off on all sorts of weird tangents, but yeah, it was it's still pretty crazy.
So, all those people who complained about funny voices, that was all leading up to this.
To this. Yeah, yeah.
So, and somehow the universe conspired to get me here because...
Yes!
I'm on hiatus. And
what are the odds?
I just happen to be, every single person in my household is somewhere doing something else without me right now.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right. This moment.
So I just decided by chance, not by chance, but by design, to stop by.
And it was intelligent design.
Yes. We're assuming.
And I've been off for a whole, like, 2 episodes, so I'm sure people missed it terribly. As evidenced by the email that said, or maybe it was a message board message, it said, the show's always good when it's just Matt and Dennis.
Ooh.
So I thought I'd come by to ruin it for you guys.
Somebody right now is furiously rushing to their keyboard to type, no, that's not what I meant. I was just trying to encourage them. And then there's always the post, the I Miss Jeff posts and the I Miss Jeff emails.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody said that last week I was channeling Jeff.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cool.
And it's the last time I tell you to get the fuck out of my body, Jeff. So, I mean, yeah, it's cool.
How dare you inhabit my body like this?
Ooh. Hey, a little left. No, so, you know... Russell's here, and that's cool, because Dennis is the only one who bothers to prepare for the show anymore. I just show up, and whatever Dennis says, I'm going to rant on. And
oh, dude,
and
you have all
dribble.
The equipment.
Well, thank you, but stop looking.
And can I just say, along with the listener base who has written in, that I, too, am very glad that you decided to soldier on with your skeleton crew, because... you know, without having the pleasure of actually venting here on a biweekly basis, I at least need to listen to you guys for entertainment.
Yeah. Well, it was scary before that, before the previous episode. Matt was like, really?
Dennis came over already.
Dropping the whole thing for a while.
Dennis came over ready to do a show, and I was sitting here tired and strung out from all the different things I was doing and was just really at a low, and I was like, you know, let's just take the summer off. And he was like, really?
And I think no one could blame you if you decided to.
But yeah. I'm not, because as it turns out, as soon as we got the show going, and it was almost instantaneous.
Yeah, you were.
I'm sure that there's a Christian out there who thinks that I become possessed by the devil as soon as we go live. But as soon as Dennis did his intro, I was fat, dumb, and happy and ready to do the show.
Yeah, you were energized the moment you started talking. It was great.
It's a good thing Russell's here, because I'm not quite so energized today.
Okay.
I'm feeling
I will let me shoulder your burden, brother.
So anyway, enough sucking up to ourselves. Well, you know, you've done the announcements, kind of, and as we mentioned last week, we've just been bent over by public access television and forced to move into a new time slot. The TV show, which used to air from 4:30 to 6, was intelligently designed to be perfect so that we could do all the other things that we do on Sunday. And now the public access has moved us to a 1:30 to 3 p.m. time slot on Sunday.
Gag.
Yeah, which is very gag.
You know, I gotta say, the 4:30 time slot, good as it was, there was huge fuss over that when we moved from 9 a.m., which is what we used to be years ago.
Man.
But 1:30 is a really bad time.
Yeah, it's not.
A
it's not that
uniquely bad time, I think.
It may turn out that we actually have more of an audience and more callers, and that I'm fine with, and I don't. You know, don't have any problem with that being a possibility. But it fucks up everything else we planned. Where we normally would have 11:30 meetings at Ventana del Sol, we're actually going to have to move that forward a little to 11 so people can actually have a chance to eat and talk before rushing off the studio. The lecture series, which normally starts 12:15-ish, if you got a show going live at 1:30, nobody involved in the show can be at the lecture. And tomorrow I was supposed to give the lecture and decided to bow out in order to do the TV show. And then we were doing dinner after the show, and who wants to go to dinner at 3:30 in the afternoon?
Right.
So we're making some adjustments, and we're shifting things, and the announcements are going to change a little bit. But the show is going to go on. It'll be on tomorrow, 1:30 to 3, and as always, we'll try and get the video up on Google as soon as possible. I realize there was at least one show where
that show
took some
the
time.
The Atheist Experience.
Yes. Thank you.
I don't think you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Also available
show,
as a podcast.
The Atheist Experience.
In addition to downloading this program, you can also download The Atheist Experience.
What are the
and that
odds?
Has video associated with it, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, you
yeah.
can either download it as the audio portion as an MP3 or podcast, but you can also go to Google Video.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us a while to get some of them up.
What Matt Dillahunty looks like.
Oh, gosh. I hate to do that to people, because all it does is flood my inbox with marriage proposals and stuff. I am so pretty. All right, the thing is that we're up to, like, show 503, I think, is what this Sunday show will be. That doesn't mean we've necessarily done 500 of them, but it's damn close. There are some that are missing. We've got a couple hundred, several hundred, I think, up on Google now. And stuff, old stuff that I hadn't even... Stuff that actually aired maybe even while I was still a believer, but certainly before I had any involvement with the ACA. So, I mean, there's good stuff up there. I don't know if we have any up with Ray yet, but there's quite a few up with Martin, and then some from when Ashley was hosting, a lot when Russell was hosting, and some from Jeff D.
Oh, good. I'll have to go admire my own prettiness.
Yes. That's the real reason Russell had to take 2 weeks off, is my room can't handle that much pretty. So he had to go away for a while.
Wow.
But...
Leaves me as the ugly one.
So the announcements, we just didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
The announcements aren't going to be regular for a while, and we're still shuffling around what we're going to do with the ACA. But, you know, we've been rambling here, and I think that people want us to actually get to, like, I don't know, news and listener mail and ranting.
Yeah.
And don't really care about
stuff.
When we're going to meet.
We forgot a story last week. A sad story. Where a scientist, Miller,
Yes.
Mm.
Passed away. Famous for the Uri Miller experiments.
That's Stanley Miller.
Stanley Miller, yeah. Yes. That showed that putting an electric charge through what we then thought of as the primordial atmosphere actually created the building blocks of life, amino acids.
Yep.
And shows that, yes, with a little, you know, with some starting chemicals, a little input of energy, order appears. So
one of the most important experiments ever performed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The creationists immediately object and will say, and by the way, we can't forget to trash Ken Ham later, because he's one of the people who would say this, or did at one point, that the atmosphere that they was used in the Miller-Urey experiments was wrong.
Was wrong, unfortunately. Now we know. Yeah.
You know what? Those creationists are absolutely right, and it doesn't frickin' matter.
It's utterly irrelevant.
It completely misses the point in the way that an awful lot of the theistic arguments do miss the point.
Right. I mean,
they say, okay, if God doesn't exist, then where did life come from, or where did the universe come from, what started the Big Bang, et cetera, et cetera. You can't answer that. So the only possible answer is God.
Right.
Then you say, no. Here's one possible answer. You see, you can create amino acids this way without intelligence. And then they say, but we don't know that it actually did happen that way, so God is still a possibility.
Right.
Oh, no. You said God was the only possibility.
Yeah.
Now you're excited that...
They'll use specifics and details to obscure the point of the thing. And, you know, if the devil's in the details, why are the Christians using details?
Maybe that's why the Christians don't understand the details.
Yeah.
I think you could probably turn that initial argument on its head right from the get-go and say, if the universe did not spontaneously create itself, then what is your other explanation? And if, you know, if there isn't any other explanation that's viable, blah, blah, blah. You have to point out that there, as we talked about the other day, trying to solve a mystery with a mystery.
Right.
That's not the way things work.
So often
it doesn't get us anything explanatory.
So often when I'm arguing with theists, they'll bring up one unevidenced thing to establish another unevidenced thing. And I'm going, that doesn't work.
The other thing is this assumption that because they've been given something that appears to be an answer, and in reality it's a non-answer.
And one that they like.
Yes, and one which is comfortable and leads to all kinds of other things which make them feel good. But because they've been given this answer, that they have this kind of presupposition that there should be an answer, and we should know and understand what that is right now.
Right.
And that's not the case. One thing, you know, we've been talking to a guy in an email, several of us, and one of the things that I said was, let's go back 15,000 years, before there was any notion of Big Bang, no hypotheses or anything else.
Right.
And I ask you, where did we come from? And your answer is, God did it. And I ask, how can you possibly know that? And your answer is, because there's no better answer. Now, 15,000 years later, we can have the exact same conversation. Absolutely nothing about that conversation or their answer has changed except for the way they decide to phrase it. Because now there actually are other possible explanations, other hypotheses that we're considering, things which are infinitely more plausible than positing a supernatural, transcendent, intelligent being.
Yeah. So how do they phrase their response now?
What we've got is the Kalam cosmological argument is what we've been talking about.
Specifically designed to weasel around the usual problems with the cosmological argument. You know, normally they say, everything has a cause, and therefore, there must be a first cause which doesn't have a cause. And then right away that contradicts the original argument.
Right.
So, you say, then you've just said something wrong. I mean,
it's not a rule.
You just declared that there is something that doesn't require a cause. So then the weasel is, in the Kalam argument specifically, and I don't know how it got that name, but in the Kalam argument, they say everything needs a cause that had a beginning.
Oh, yes.
And that just changes the terms
the
of the word because you gotta focus on that concept of everything that had a beginning.
Right.
Because they say, okay, now there's something that didn't have a beginning. I call that God.
Right.
Really? What properties do you assume God has? Is it just a little speck somewhere that didn't have a beginning? Is that your God?
And hey, if now you've posited something that doesn't have a beginning, yet, you know, okay, you say everything has a cause, right? Well, where did you get that rule from? Well, we see that everything does have a cause, right? Okay, so now you're positing something that doesn't have a beginning. Where did you get that from?
Right.
Yeah. I just made it up.
there's so many objections. I mean, this Kalam cosmological argument has been popularized lately by William Lane Craig, and it comes off as being it's a valid argument, but it's unsound.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the biggest problem. It's easy to spot invalid arguments, but ones that are valid but unsound, and you can go look that up because
it has hidden assumptions.
Yes, and basically what it's hiding is the fact that we're defining into existence the very thing that the argument is trying to prove.
Right.
And in the first premise where you say everything that began to exist has a cause, you're also relying on a bit of, as Russell's pointed out, equivocation. Because what we're saying isn't that the universe had a beginning, but that the current state of the universe had a point in time at which it began. We can't say anything at all about what the state was before. We can't say specifically. And one of the possible theories is that if you take a look at the universe as it exists now, or what we call the universe, which is really that the universe itself is an ambiguous term, depending, you know, people can interpret differently. But it could be looked at as this complex web of causal chains, perhaps one big long chain, or you know, if you're looking at time, or a web of interwoven chains. Now, if you work backwards past the Planck time to a point where you arrive at the mathematical singularity, all you can say about that singularity from what we know is that it must necessarily include all of the matter and energy of the universe. And if that's the case, there's no reason to assume that this web of causal chains stopped. There may have been interactions within self-contained within the singularity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in time, there you bring in another potentially confusing concept along with infinity. But at some point, this internal causal chain, one of the effects of it may have been for the universe to expand.
Right.
That's a very plausible explanation. I'm not saying it's true. I'm not saying it's the best one. I'm not saying it's accepted, anything else. But what it is it's an explanation that does not die to Occam's razor, because we haven't posited any unproven, unnecessary external actions.
And it is based on something.
Yeah,
it is based on evidence.
It's a scientific model where the explanation is based on things we know and understand to some degree, and when you do it the other way, with the God done it or magic man done it, you're positing something that we know absolutely nothing about, and you are therefore just simply saying, okay, here's a mystery that needs to be solved by something based on my assumptions with qualities X, Y, and Z. So I'm therefore going to define an entity and call it first cause or God or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and it necessarily has qualities X, Y, and Z.
Right. I'll just assign it properties.
In my opinion, I mean, you know, the cosmological argument in all its forms is designed to be as nonspecific and ambiguous as possible, because like intelligent design, they're trying to pretend that they're not arguing necessarily for the specific Christian biblical God. They just want to get you in a position where you admit that there must be a God of some kind, and then they hope to reason from there that it's going to be the Christian God. In my opinion, the Achilles heel of those cosmological arguments is the intelligence part. because even when they don't specify the Christian God, they build in an assumption that whatever the first cause was is intelligent.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. when I bring up that idea of the infinite, of the single particle of matter that has no cause, they don't like that at all.
Yeah.
Even though it's consistent with the cosmological argument.
Yeah, you could have the singularity, and then the one point that Russell's talking about, which the point is actually something external to the singularity, and if it collides, it therefore acts as a cause, which you know, we don't know anything about it, but we can presume that it's necessary or sufficient to cause the expansion.
And they say, oh, there must be a first cause, which we'll call God. Just a word I happen to pluck out of the air. Not that it has any significance to it. And they pretend that the word God doesn't have all this extra baggage, like intelligence, involved in it.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, out of all of the arguments that we get presented regularly, the Kalam cosmological argument is at least one where I can understand why people would buy into it.
Right.
Because it does have, even though it's, you know, unsound and flawed, it requires a lot more to suss out exactly what's wrong with it than, for example, Pascal's wager or Paley's watchmaker.
I think there are two arguments that I consider hard to counter. Not that they have no counters, but that it takes a long but that I haven't found a good shortcut to explain it easily. I think cosmological argument may be one of them, and the other one is the whole sticky issue of human morality.
Yeah, and it's not that they're, you know, like you were saying, it's not that they're overly difficult. It's just that you definitely aren't going to be able to soundbite those very easily.
Right.
And it's maybe the case that, you know, like if you take a look at Pascal's wager, there's so much wrong with it that, I mean, we've done an entire episode of the show on it and still didn't hit everything that's wrong with it.
Right.
When you take Paley's watchmaker, there is so much wrong with that I tried to hit it in like 2 or 3 minutes at the end of the show and immediately got an email saying, oh, but you missed the best, you know, and maybe
right,
I did. You know, there's so many. To these others, they take on an appearance. Like I said, there's this idea of a logically valid syllogism that's unsound because its premises are unsound. And then in the morality issue, it's, they rely on things that we don't necessarily have a good understanding of.
Right.
We have a much better understanding of, you know, game theory as it applies to Pascal's wager or...
Well, the reason I think it's hard is because it appeals to some philosophical issues which I think are not resolved. Like, does it really make sense to say that there is such a thing as objective standards for morality? Right. Certainly religion doesn't have it.
Right.
I mean, So, I mean, that's one reason why Jeff started encouraging everybody to use the Euthyphro argument a few years ago, which is not necessarily to defend atheism as a means to getting to morality, but just to point out the obvious fact that religion as a way of providing objective morality doesn't work worth a damn.
Right.
But there's still the underlying question of, is there such a thing? I mean, like, I would like to say unequivocally that slavery is wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't really feel that I can. And again, certainly religious people can't say that unequivocally because their holy book endorses it.
I can't say there's an intrinsic, you know, right or wrong and stuff like that. But there are certainly behaviors that result in healthier societies than other behaviors.
Right.
We had a discussion about this at Iron Chariots.
Yeah.
I'm perfectly happy, and I'm not saying slavery is intrinsically wrong, but I'm perfectly happy in stating that any system that advocates slavery is necessarily immoral. And I realize that you get into this whole wishy-washy thing about, you know, oh, is it your own subjective morality and all this? No, it's I've explained it there, and I don't want to get sidetracked onto it today.
Impractical. It's not to the benefit
of society.
Not if you're
a master.
Well, my basic position is that when you're going about constructing any sort of ethical system,
mm-hmm.
you have to start with a few basic assumptions. In any ethical system that that has value, that promotes a healthy society,
mm-hmm.
Some of those assumptions are necessarily in conflict with the idea of slavery.
Right, right.
And if the basic assumptions are, I want to live and perhaps have possessions and whatever, let's just say that I want to live and exercise my own freedom, my own
right.
free will.
Sure.
Or whatever we would choose to call it, that it behooves me to join with other people who agree with that, within form a society that is cooperative. And in part of that is that I need to extend those same rights to other people. And now all we need to deal with is the areas where they overlap,
right.
where my rights end and theirs begin. And one of the things that seems obvious is that if my rights include my ability to freely do whatever I want, then I can't possibly be the property of anybody else. And if I extend that right to everybody else, and I think as a society that's what we generally would do,
mm-hmm.
then we can say that slavery is immoral. Slavery may in fact be very, very, very beneficial to the slave owners.
Of course.
Yeah.
But as long as we don't have the mentality that the slaves are something different that don't get the same freedoms that we do,
mm-hmm.
then it's wrong.
Do you guys know about John Rawls?
Mm-mm.
He was a philosopher, I think, in the 20th century. And he came up with this concept of societal justice, where he said, let's say that you want to design the ideal society. And the question naturally arises, from whose perspective should you design the ideal society? So he said, okay, let's pretend that there is a veil of ignorance, that you don't know what the individuals are like in this society. In fact, you don't even know who you are. You could mm-hmm. be anyone in this society. If there's slaves, you could be a slave.
Mm-hmm.
If there's peasants, you could be a peasant. If there could be you could be a woman or an ethnic minority or
sure.
something. And he says, okay, so you've got this veil of ignorance over you. Now design a society that you want to live in.
Yeah.
No matter who you are.
Interesting. That's cool.
And while that approach isn't without its flaws, I'm
right,
sure, I think it's a really good way of starting to think about how we want a society to work. And in that society, you know, you wouldn't necessarily, like, I mean, you know, a lot of social conservatives would say, you know, would be scared that liberals, for instance, want to take away all the money from the rich and evenly distribute it among everybody. And under this veil of ignorance, you don't necessarily want to do that for exactly the reasons that a conservative would say, which is, you know,
right.
you discourage the more productive members of society and so on. But you do want some kind of, I mean, you know, if you are rich, you want to enjoy the benefits of being rich as much as you can. But if you are poor under the veil of ignorance, you don't want to be a serf.
You don't want to be stuck forever, yeah, in that situation.
Right.
It kind of ties in with the idea of the division of a cake, where the best solution is to have whoever cuts the cake and divides it into pieces be the last one to select their piece.
Right.
I cut and you guys get first pick. That encourages me to cut the cake as fairly as possible so that I don't end up screwing myself.
Right.
You know,
now, the slave owners of old, at least the slave owners of, I guess, the U.S., way back, they had all sorts of rationalizations. They, when argued, they would say, oh, we're uplifting them.
yeah.
from their savage beginnings in
We've removed them
Africa.
From the jungle and given
right.
them clothes and
clothes
education.
And we're uplifting them. But, of course, it's bullshit because, you know, uplifting them, oh, we're pointing them towards being equals. But, yeah. of course, it's never going to happen,
yeah.
right?
You've raised them yeah. from an F student to a D student, but you've limited them from ever possibly becoming a C student or higher.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I was just listening to another show on the way here where the host was talking about the sort of unequal hostility that women have to deal with on when they're public figures or when they're talking on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all men here, and we're used to being called,
that's right.
you know, liars and idiots.
Sure.
But when you have a woman speaking out, there's kind of an unequal distribution of criticism in the sense that there have been like bloggers who went and expressed unpopular opinions, and they said, you know, I hope you fucking die, you whore, cunt, slut.
Yeah.
And sort of, I mean, like, it seems like it's hard to have an opinion as a woman without getting extra sexualized commentary leveled at you.
Mm. Well, we call guys dicks and assholes. And
we
and
do, but I don't think it carries the same kind of implied stigma as calling someone a whore.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Of course, we're guilty of that, too. Just think of our past shows about Ann Coulter.
Which... And I'm somebody who's
guilty.
I'm impossible to offend or nearly impossible to offend.
Yeah.
But I can be made uncomfortable.
Uh huh.
And the Ann Coulter show made me uncomfortable.
Right.
It was over the top. I thought
we backed off of that.
Yeah.
But hey.
And I think one good reason to back off is because we found people who are worse, like Debbie Schlussel.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Debbie Schlussel is worse than Ann Coulter.
Only because she's not as popular.
She's
Ann's evil twin. Eviler twinner.
Shorter uh-huh. and less skinny. And Jewish.
So now it's, you know, after talking about how women get the extra baggage, now it's fat folks who get the extra baggage.
She's not fat, I don't think.
Yeah,
but
then why point
actually,
out, like,
I'm doing it again. I mean, mm-hmm. another thing mm-hmm. he was commenting on was how there's always also talking about women's looks, which doesn't happen so much with men.
I disagree there.
But
it's plays itself in a slightly different way, but it still happens. How many times has somebody called in the show to, you know, do the bald or fat or, you know, whatever?
I suppose.
Looks are the first thing we get.
Right.
I mean, it's a first impression, and I think that's
going
to be picked on.
You know,
equally.
We get innuendos that we're gay.
I will say that say that in addition to, you know, women having to bear this extra kind of language of that is sexual in nature, that may in fact be offset by a sort of special or favored treatment that they also get too. Whereas if you have a number of people posting on a blog and one of them is obviously female and one of them is obviously male, and they both say something that, let's say they're both Christians or whatever, and they happen to use this particular argument that is offensive, you know, and condescending to non-believers, the reaction, while the woman does risk special names being thrown at her,
mm-hmm.
there's also a strong chance that people will go easier on her.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
It's the don't hit a woman mentality mm-hmm. Extended into the online world.
But I just don't know if it does extend so much into the online world. I mean, I think it's true that attacks on women when they do get attacks can be more violent in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, you know, we haven't gotten to any of the things that we were initially going to talk about, but it does lead into one of them, or two of them, actually. One of them is this idea, and this has come up recently on Possum Mama's blog, as recently as last night, actually, of how far is too far? Because when I go and I say, for example, that Christian beliefs are, in fact, immoral or ridiculous or whatever else I happen to say, someone made the point that I end up, in their eyes at least, looking just as bad as the Christian who's coming on saying, oh, if only you could see God's love, maybe you wouldn't have to burn in hell.
Hmm. Right.
And I try to point out,
or the liberals and abortionists and ACLU are responsible for September 11th.
Yeah, and I tried to point out that this is really kind of a reforming of this. I have beliefs, you have beliefs. They're all to be respected, and let's just all get along. And what that does is it sets up religious beliefs for special treatment. That if somebody has a notion which is ridiculous or harmful or damaging, under any other normal circumstances, we would be fine to criticize it. We would be justified in saying, no, I'm, you know, if somebody comes up and says, I'm not a drug addict, and we say, no, in fact, you are a drug addict. You do have a problem. You are harming yourself, and by extension, you're harming others as well. But if they say that it's their religious belief,
mm-hmm.
now all of a sudden it needs to be kind of a hands-off, as this is a personal kind of esoteric thing that doesn't matter. And the point that I tried to make repeatedly yesterday was that beliefs do matter.
Right.
Beliefs determine who we are and what we do. We use the beliefs we formulate to come up with new beliefs, and we take action based on those beliefs.
You're not really Napoleon.
Yeah.
That's why you're in an asylum.
Just because you have a belief and you label it religious doesn't mean that it's all of a sudden, you know, beyond examination or criticism, or that it deserves any special or favored treatment. If you believe the earth is flat, we can demonstrate that that's false. And
mm-hmm.
and the person that I was talking to pointed out that that's a bad example when talking about God. And
no.
On some level, it may be. On another level, it's not. Because, for example,
you can't demonstrate that God is false, but you can take the specific claims that are made about God.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I was talking to a friend recently who is kind of, I mean, he's been a Catholic all his life. He's still a Catholic, but he's been talking to my dad a lot. And so he's thinking about atheism a lot more, even if he's not going that way. I was chatting with him online, and I said, why, you know, what makes you still want to believe besides just faith? And I think I've gotten him now to a point where he says, yeah, it's just faith and that's all.
Right.
Which at least is an honest position,
yeah.
I think. But at that time, he said, well, you know, God can't be examined by science anyway. And I said, sure it can. Don't you believe in the power of prayer? And he says, oh, yeah, you know, people get healed at Lourdes and stuff.
Well, there you go.
And I said, well, that can be tested. Why do you think that's beyond the reach of science? We can take a sampling of people who go to Lourdes and see how many of them actually get better compared to people who get better from the same things in the general public.
Right.
But this particular discussion was about how you come across. And the general impression is that, well, you end up appearing kind of condescending, arrogant, elitist, I'm better than you because I don't rely on faith, and I'm better than you because, you know, I don't buy into this ridiculous, you know, notion of whatever.
We don't even have to say anything for that. I mean, just the existence of atheists means that, to the theist, there's a bunch of people out there who think we're deluded.
Yeah, the thing is, and I answered as, honestly as I can, which is, you know, something I definitely try to do at all turns, that's a bit of a kind of a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think I'm a better person than Fred Phelps? You bet your ass. In almost any category. Do right. I think I'm a better person than Jerry Falwell? In most categories, I do probably think that I'm better, and that isn't a...
You're alive.
You know, I'm alive. I've got him beat there. You know, when I take a look at morality as represented in the Christian Bible, my morality, my ethical beliefs are superior to that. I feel no reason to apologize for that. If you feel that I am being arrogant by holding that over your head, tough. It's not my fault that you have accepted an inferior morality, that you are willing to say, well, you know, there's just stuff we won't understand, and we'll have to rely on God and trust that, you know, when he says it's time for us to kill somebody, that he knows what's best and that maybe something's going to come out. That's bullshit. When you talk about, well, you think you're maybe smarter than other people. No, take, for example, Francis Collins, head of the Human Genome Project. I think that in many areas, the man may, in fact, be smarter than me. No problem with that at all.
Yeah.
When it comes to the discussion about whether or not there's good reason to think that a God exists, I'm way fucking smarter than Francis Collins, and I'm not going to apologize for that.
Well, the charge that we are like fundamentalists kind of tends to boil down to the fact that we think that our beliefs, or lack of beliefs, are better than the beliefs of those people who we're criticizing, which is another sort of red herring, because there is not a person in the world, I don't think, who doesn't think that their own beliefs
exactly.
are better than the other ones. I have a set right. of things that I think are true. If I thought that I was wrong, then I would believe differently.
Well, there is a difference.
So
though.
I think that the things that I believe are true really are true.
Right. And there is a difference in that the fundamentalist relies on faith and
yes.
thus will never give up his beliefs.
Right. Or
well,
there'll be a flip
my beliefs, well, my beliefs, however, I know they're tentative. I understand that, hey, given evidence to the contrary, I will have to change my mind.
I feel vindicated that I made this both of those exact 2 points in the discussion.
Yeah.
I'm not dogmatically asserting that my beliefs are necessarily absolutely the best. I will say that I do believe that they're true.
Right.
That I do believe they're better. That my mind is open to change, but only open to change with some very specific limitations, and they're really fucking easy. One, provide solid evidence.
Right.
Two, provide sound, reasoned arguments to support a position that's better. You do those two, and I'll change my mind, and I'm living proof that I've fucking done so, because I used to hold those fundamentalist beliefs.
You know, I think it's very, it's a very good thing to sometimes change your mind on things, even small things, and say so publicly. Having a post at some point that says I was wrong about this and, you know, thus and such, even if it's not a big thing, it sort of reveals something about your character.
Yeah, I've done that many times on Alt Atheism.
And I'm proud to be able to point to past things I've written where I said, I used to think this way and I don't think that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, you know, the other thing is that
intellectual honesty.
You know,
because nobody knows everything, and anybody who hasn't changed any of their beliefs in like 10 years
right.
is really missing something.
This is the infallibility of the theist thing.
Yeah.
You know, they say, "Oh, I have a God is good." Well, you've just judged God. You know.
Yeah. You have, in fact, used your own moral beliefs to determine whether or not something is good or evil. But, you know, the notion of, well, you think you're better or you think you're smarter or, you know what, sometimes that is true.
Yeah, sure.
In the broad, generalized sense in which you're using it, it's definitely not true. You can't go around assuming that I automatically think that I'm better or smarter than people who disagree with me, because that's not the case. But one thing...
I've made mistakes.
Yeah.
and I can make them again.
I made mistakes last week when we were talking about the kid science project. I went off with like magnesium sulfate or something, and it was actually, and I've forgotten now. So see, not only did I get it wrong, but I've forgotten why I got it wrong. But this idea of that it's condescending, or that we should bite our tongues mm-hmm. and not challenge beliefs that we think are untrue and false, for fear that we might offend somebody or hurt their feelings, that to me is absolutely asinine. I'm not advocating running around, getting in everybody's faces, going, you're a fucktard for believing this. That's not even close to it. I'm saying that if for no other reason than if you have a belief that you strongly believe and it's directly contradictory to what I understand to be true, it's in my best interest and your best interest for me to point out why I disagree with you and for you to try and point out why you disagree with me and for us to both to analyze what's taken place there to try and determine what the truth may be. Now, that mentality has led some people in the kind of feel-good community to develop this idea that the truth lies somewhere in the middle.
Right.
That's not true.
No.
One of the two beliefs may actually be true from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I am one of those people that people might call a militant atheist or an angry atheist.
Sure.
At least in the terms that they say it.
Yeah.
The thing is, I mean, you know, I talk on these shows. I get heated sometimes. I argue with people. But I never start arguments with just casual people. I mean, I really feel that I don't pick fights with people. What happens is they say when I hear another person saying something very polemic that I think is wrong, I listen to them for a while, and if they keep saying it with a level of certainty, then I correct them.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes leads to arguments, but one of the things that I've gotten more comfortable with over the years is this is going to lead to an argument if I correct this, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, well, when I get heated in arguments, it's not because I hate the other person, I don't get heated because I disagree with them. I get heated if they refuse to understand what I'm saying,
right?
Even if they think it's wrong, if they'll misrepresent what I just said, or if they'll try to obscure it, or if they'll...
Mm-hmm.
It's dishonest tactics will just drive me nuts.
Yeah, well, I mean, we get called angry atheists, but the fact is we happen to get into arguments with a lot of very angry people.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just avoid those conversations.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Now,
if
you decide to make it a purpose to go ahead and identify those people who are angry, strident, and wrong...
Yes, and here we are in a podcast with a big cross, target drawn on us.
Yeah. Right. And you get involved in these discussions with and about these angry people... the perception is going to kind of rub off on you.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think that one of the things is that it's the subject matter that we're talking about. We're talking about, most often, core beliefs, things that people have very strong opinions about because they're foundational to developing who they are. And, you know, while we are intensely curious and social, we are also... kind of fearful of being wrong, resistant to change, and it's embarrassing to find that perhaps the core of your worldview is mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
That it's okay. I mean, you know, it's okay to admit mistakes, and I think most people will generally admit to small mistakes, even semi-regularly. But that's a big mistake. That's a mistake that has informed everything else about your existence, or in some cases, perhaps not, for the people who just believe to be believing or claim to believe in order to fit in. But yeah, the subject matter, people believe strongly about. And when Dawkins, for example, gets accused of being overly polemic or the angry militant fundamentalist atheist.
Which I have to say, I really don't think he is. He's the most calm, mild-mannered, you know, adorable little atheist that I've ever seen.
He's in a very different boat from Christopher Hitchens, who recently lauded by a reviewer as not being one of the angry atheists. And I thought, well, this is an interesting perception. But Dawkins' answer is that, and I agree, they're confusing passion, people feeling passionate about their beliefs, for a sort of fundamentalist dogmatic mentality. Mm-hmm. Because where they normally see that sort of passion may in fact come from those dogmatic sources. Mm-hmm. I think the odd little interview or the odd little assessment of Christopher Hitchens is one where Chris is extremely open.
Mm-hmm.
You ask him what he thinks, he'll tell you what he thinks, he doesn't give a damn if you agree with him or not. He is very forceful, even when he's at his calmest.
Mm-hmm.
But his demeanor doesn't normally change. I haven't seen him go off on a real rant because he's always in this mild state of rant. And therefore, that comes across as more of his persona. When he's being snide and condescending, and trust me, the man can be very good at being snide and condescending, it just looks like him. Whereas when Dawkins gets excited, for example, when he went head-to-head with Ted Haggard, and his demeanor changed.
Yeah, his demeanor didn't even get up to the level of Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah, he didn't get to the level of Christopher Hitchens, but it changed so much from the norm that there's more of a contrast there. I think there's less contrast with Christopher Hitchens. I think he's pretty much
stable. Did you see Christopher Hitchens talk to Hannity and Combs?
Yes. And
now, I think it would be fair to say that he was angry there.
I would have been much... You would have seen... I still didn't see the stark difference between his personality. It was a slight change. Mm-hmm. I would have gone from starting much calmer than Christopher to being much more agitated. Because they were really just being rude and dismissive.
They were baiting him.
And they deserved much more than what they got.
Oh, yeah.
What did they say? I remember he said something like, you know, look, you invite me on your show just to talk at me or about me.
Yeah.
You know, if you want me to stay on the show, then you have to let me say what I want to say.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what it was.
But
I mean, he nailed Hannity. I mean, this is exactly what those guys do.
You just turn your mic off or adjust it or something.
Wait, hello?
Okay, you're good.
Okay.
Don't fiddle.
He nailed Hannity.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say. Not in the sexual way.
No.
In the Colbert way.
Because that would be gross.
Yes.
All right.
You're on notice.
Bring in a piece of listener mail?
Bring in a piece of mail.
That dovetails with this somewhat.
Okay.
Ethan writes...
Do we know where Ethan's from?
Yes. Let's see. I think he tells us where... No,
number,
he's only
Social
our
Security.
Friend in Reason.
Okay.
Ethan from Reason says...
Yes.
I don't know how to do the Reason accent.
He's in high school, apparently.
Oh.
And
I think it would be great.
We mentioned The Secret. Silliness of The Secret a while back.
The secret being this popular book that says that all you have to do is wish for things real hard and you'll get it.
Yeah. In my adult living class, what the hell?
Yeah. I meant to ask him if this was actually a public school class, but he's in high school and is in an adult living class.
Okay. Whatever that means. And it says, my teacher had us watch The Secret. When they misrepresented quantum mechanics and the theory of electricity, I was enraged. I used all of my self-control to simply not stand up and scream what was wrong with the fucking movie. After some dickhead said that no one knows what electricity was, but we still use it, the flow of electrons from point A to B, I got up and walked out of the room.
Good for you.
If nothing else, it gave my classmates something to think about. Then I walked down to the high school office and had a talk with the principal about the event. My principal talked with my teacher, and then my teacher demanded a public apology for walking out and talking to the principal. And he adds, one that will never be given.
Amen.
I did use the opportunity to talk about how the movie was counter to reason, how it misrepresented science, and how it slandered the name of some of the smartest men in history. Greatest men in history. For the most part, my classmates were supportive. I had one kid heckle me because my words were too big. Is that militant atheism? No, it's me being passionate about science.
Yeah.
Exactly the point you're making.
Ethan is the one who should be demanding an apology.
Exactly.
Ethan and his parents should get together and go to the school board and demand that the teacher be reprimanded and publicly apologize for attempting to pollute the minds of high school students with this nonsensical bullshit that amounts to cross your fingers and if it doesn't work, it's your fucking fault.
Well, here's another belief, the secret is, which has different parts to it, some of which can't be studied and verified by science, but many of which can. If you say, if you wish for something real hard, then you'll get it. It's hard to put up a good experiment for that. But if you make these specific claims about quantum mechanics and electricity, and you can be pretty much objectively wrong.
Right.
Well, it's the another thing about The Secret, apart from it being one of the most vile bits of pseudo-religious tripe trash crap I've ever heard of.
At least the most vile recent one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that it can be compared to what we know about the power of prayer. And if The Secret is in fact true, then what we know is that nobody has ever seriously or desperately wished for world peace. Nobody has seriously, desperately wished to an end to hunger, to cancer, to anything. Nobody's really done this right. And if that's the case, then there's no good reason for anybody at home to think that they're going to be the ones to get it right. And, oh, by the way, there's no good reason to think that any of this crap is true in the first place.
Right.
But I'm really, along with some other people, extremely pissed off that people like Oprah are pushing this, which just continues to victimize people. And not only does it make them victims, it does so while exploiting them for cash.
Mm-hmm.
Pricks.
Now, there's a rather disturbing thing at the end of it, though. P.S. Other than my family and friends, the only thing I would die for is reason.
Hmm.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
I'd die for it. Maybe he's thinking of a sort of Galileo-like situation where they're like, you know, say you didn't see that thing in the telescope, bitch.
Yeah.
If I was in that case, I'd probably go, okay, yeah, I didn't see that thing in the telescope. And then I'd continue my scientific researches, gather as much data as I can, and hide it for a more enlightened time.
Yeah, see, yeah, I don't think that lying is inherently an evil thing.
No.
I think it's often a bad choice in most situations. Mm-hmm. But I think I don't have a problem with lying about something to save my life or somebody else's.
No, I don't either. And it's not... I have made a purpose for myself of attempting to be as honest and truthful as possible at all times. But there are some things that are nobody else's business, and there are some things that, in some cases, like Russell pointed out, where the best course of action, the action that provides the most good, is in fact a lie.
Right.
There may be, and that's an interesting topic that maybe we should talk about like next time, is would you die for something, and what is it that you would actually die for? What, you know, I don't have any kids, so obviously I can't say that, although I know there are parents who, with a quickness, would say, I would die to save the life of my kid. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure that I would. I think maybe I might.
Right. And, of course, it depends on... trying to answer a hypothetical like that is always a problem because, you know, you don't know what you're going to do until that situation occurs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's no way to really be honest and say what you would do.
I joined the military and was in there for 8 years, which implies that I was willing to give my life for the ideals of my country. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you just kind of do and accept. I don't think that that's necessarily true for myself, and I don't think it's necessarily true for the people who are actually in the military right now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a a false hypothetical, because what you're really saying is, if push comes to shove, I'll go ahead and commit to this course of action, but I'm actively hoping and that it doesn't happen, and it's unlikely that it would, especially if you join in a peacetime.
Your level of commitment, I'm sure, changes based on what the perceived risks are. I mean, like, if somebody said, okay, you know, you can sign up for the military, but we're going to put you in a suicide unit that will be, you know, we promise that it's for the good of the country, but you're going to be doing some operations that have like a 99% chance that you'll die. I think that a lot fewer people would be signing up for the army.
Yeah. This seems to be what the madrasas are. A bunch of those are.
That's
doing
true.
Well.
And I think there's
another element there too,
in
where you've polluted somebody's mind enough that they're going to accept things that they ordinarily wouldn't rationally accept. When I was in, we were one of the first people to go down to Haiti when there was a conflict down there, and it was one of the only. I was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Provide Comfort, and a number of other operations, but the Haiti one was the only one, because I was in the Navy, where I actually had to suit up with Kevlar vest and helmet, where I was given a rifle and ammunition, and where there was actual people shooting at or near me. And so I've been in a situation where I could have died, but even then, it was not a high probability. I mean, there were the Marines that were there the night before us were sleeping in a place, and somebody had come in with an AK-47 and actually fired through the walls at all of them, but they were all asleep that night. So there was real danger, and I was real frickin' nervous on occasion, but I plodded through and did what I had said I was going
to
do.
Yeah, and you don't sign up for the Army to die. I mean, even when you consider how many people die who sign up for military, you know, it's probably like on the order of 1%. Which is much worse than in the private sector, and anybody who says that Iraq is as safe as California is just an idiot. But 1% is still way better than the, you know, hypothetical 99% chance of dying that I think it would be really hard to persuade anyone to sign up for the military if they believed those were the odds.
Yeah. The other thing, and this is kind of a personal revelation that I had after the fact, because it was this whole thing of you're going to die for your country, or you could possibly die for your country. And we have people who have died for the country in all kinds of engagements. When I was in that position in Haiti where it became a reality that death was a possibility, the kind of epiphany that I had was that if I were to die, it wasn't, in fact, me dying for my country. It was me dying for my word. I was fulfilling the obligation that I'd made, because I, even at that time, I didn't necessarily agree with every decision the government was making. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily agree with, you know, the way taxes were spent or all these other things. So this kind of ambiguous term of you're dying for your country is silly. What I had done was given my word to take some action that I felt, for the most part, possibly fulfilled some greater good. Mm-hmm. And if I were to die, it would be dying to fulfill my obligation and live up to my word, not anything to do with, you know, how much I loved the country. Although I'm happy to be American.
Wasn't it General Patton who said something along the lines of, you know, it's not noble to die for your country. The point is to make the other bastard die for his country.
Right.
Most definitely.
Wow.
Yeah, avoiding death is a good thing. I plan to try and avoid death for as long as I fucking can.
Yes.
What else you got?
Oh, let's see. A couple of people wrote in about the deal where we were talking about rape in the Bible.
Yeah.
Stuff.
And made really good corrections, because I had said that, you know, okay, the Bible doesn't actually say thou shalt rape.
Right.
But I had given examples where, you know, it could almost be interpreted that way. There actually are some passages where it, for all intents and purposes, does instruct people to rape. You know, the whole thing of...
Yeah. Let's see. Jim says, in Meteline Falls, says, in Numbers 31, God commanded Moses to kill everyone in Midian, but all the women, children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. And he's pointing out it's not just
cookies.
Not just thou shalt rape, but thou shalt statutory rape.
Right.
Yeah.
That's one, and then there's also the if you want a woman, but she doesn't want you, you can rape her and then pay her dad and get away with it.
See, but I think that may be an unintended consequence of bad law design.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that they didn't write that law with the idea in mind that, hey, this provides an incentive to rape.
I can tell you,
they just thought it was a fair punishment in some way.
I think, from my point of view, they wrote it with an idea in mind that's very similar to why, like, for example, if a girl's raped today and gets pregnant, the anti-abortion crowd are like, tough shit.
Some of
that,
them are.
Yeah. Many of them, that's their mentality. I think this is similar to what we're seeing in there, where it's, this woman's been raped by a man. No other man's going to want her now because she's no longer pure. So what's the best course of action? Okay, we'll let that guy have her for 50 shekels. You know. And I think that's the way they looked at it. But there was another example somebody wrote in about a passage in Deuteronomy that I'd almost forgotten about. It's Deuteronomy 21, verses 10 through 14. Dave wrote this in for us, I think. When you go forth to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them unto your hands, and you take them captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you have desire for her, and would take her for yourself as wife, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall put off all her captive's garb, and remain in your house, and bewail her father and mother for a whole month. After that, you may go up into her, which is penetration, and be her husband.
Sure, that's what they mean.
Yes.
Are you sure it's not just like you may go into her room or something like that? Is it the translation?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a euphemism. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Then if you, this has nothing to do with what her wishes are. So you've captured this woman, brought her home, you give her a month to cry and moan, and then all of a sudden you can go in and have sex with her. It doesn't matter what she thinks about it, and she's your wife. But if she doesn't please you, you can then let her go wherever she wants, but you can't sell her for money. You shall not treat her as a slave, since you've humiliated her. So you can fuck her, but you can't sell her off if you don't like it. If she's bad in the sack, you just got to let her go her way.
Hmm.
And that kind of makes me wonder, if you're a woman and all your people have been killed.
This was probably really progressive thinking back then.
Yeah. If you're a woman and all your people have been killed and you've been captured and forced to shave your head, clip your nails so that you can't defend yourself with, you know, whatever you've got with your body, and cry for a month, and then some guy comes in and has sex with you, are you going to try and make it very good? Wouldn't your best course of action to be the, you know,
right,
to lay there like a limp rag and let him get it over with, and then he's going to let you go?
Well, you know, some cultures,
bad
I don't know
design.
I don't know if this is the case back in that particular culture, but you know, in some cultures, I believe men who make off with women are considered manly and desirable in a way. I don't know how true this is of real societies, but I remember at least recently reading in Song of Ice and Fire, which is a fantasy series, of course, but I mean the guy tends to base it on real cultures, that there's this whole group of people who, where they're like, well, I just, you know, the women are like, I need to be with a man who's strong enough to steal me.
Maybe there's a bit of like the Helsinki syndrome in there too, where they've come to appreciate their captors, and then
maybe
people see this after the fact and go, wow, not only did he steal her away from, you know, her family, but now she loves him for it. He must truly be great.
Right.
And kind of past posting what the real thing
and
is.
And I think it is fair to point out, I mean, I'm not just being facetious when I say this might have been very progressive thinking at the time. I mean, saying you don't, you know, you can't sell her, you can't make her marry you. I mean, that a lot of the things in the Bible that we regard today as terrible were just the norm back then and even mitigated somewhat by the Bible. Like, I did a bar mitzvah when I was 13, and everybody has to read and comment on a passage in the Bible, and mine was the famous eye for an eye passage. You know, you take an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. And the commentary that I found, I guess mostly my rabbi told me, so I don't know how correct this is, but it's that the norm back then was to escalate things, so you could take a life for an eye. And and so part of the point of that passage is you only take an eye for an eye.
So it was better.
But we're better now than then.
Yeah, and then later on you get to this Jesus guy who says, you know, turn the other cheek. So he's advocating something that is less than what you're entitled
to. Yes, and he even specifically denounces the part of an eye for an eye.
Right. And yet, despite that, this same individual decides that a proper recourse for people lending money around the church is to go hand make a scourge and chase them out and throw at the threat of physical violence. And if you think he probably didn't hit anybody, then I think it's just a matter of, you know, him being a pussy with bad aim.
For lack of
because he went in there to beat the hell out of those guys.
Yeah.
Or, you know, beat the hell into them, evidently. Oh, and by the way, this is the same kind of progressive thinking that says if you cannot force yourself to accept these propositions as true, you're going to hell.
Mm-hmm. To be tortured forever.
Well, that's an interesting thing because there's a. I've been, you know, we all know that people like Billy Graham will say that there's no such thing as a physical hell place and that hell is simply separation from God. So this idea of torture is false. And when you look through what's in the Bible about hell, it appears on some occasions that it talks about, you know, a lake of fire and stuff. But it turns out that those may not actually be descriptions of hell or what people's concept of hell at any one time was. Billy Graham has a good case to, you know, and this is the thing of you can find within the Bible passages that appear to support whatever position you want to take. And with the notion of hell, which is mistranslated a number of times, sometimes it was just Gehenna, which was, you know, a valley where they would dump bodies and stuff.
Right.
So you have some passages that would support an idea of hell.
Right, but I don't care if Billy Graham thinks that I'll be physically tortured, because what he does believe still includes I'll be conscious, I'll be unhappy.
No.
You will
cease to exist.
Okay, see, I already think I'm going to cease to exist,
yeah,
so that doesn't scare me.
See, but what it does is it serves as a threat, in a way, because you won't get to live on forever like
in this glorious
like
place
the other folks, like the people who are saved, raptured, whatever.
Right. But it's this whole weird ass, you know, I've got mine kind of thinking. I'm saved. I've got mine. You know.
Okay. Wait. I have to interrupt to do something we talked about earlier. Which was admit that I'm wrong.
Oh, no!
Uh-oh.
It's not Helsinki syndrome. It's Stockholm syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a complete fucking moron. The sad thing is that...
Munchausen.
The sad thing is that the first thing I thought of was the Nightingale syndrome, where you fall for your doctor type thing. Which, if I got that one wrong, too, let me know.
That's the Florence Nightingale effect. I know it from Back to the Future.
Yes. And maybe it's not syndrome, maybe it's effect, and that's where I got it wrong. But, yeah, it's not Helsinki. Somebody living in Helsinki is like, what the hell are you talking about?
The Czechoslovakia syndrome.
It's Stockholm syndrome. So there, I was wrong.
Cool.
And I'm happy. That's the other thing. I'm happy that somebody corrected me so that I don't stupidly go off and make myself look like a moron again next time about, you know, something like that. And that's the way science is. That's the way scientists are.
When
you know,
you're willing
yes, they
to
can,
learn things, you get better.
Yeah. You know, yes, they have perhaps a strong attachment to their current theory. But when scientists are proven wrong, they get almost giddy, because what this does is open up a whole new realm of possibilities.
Right.
And when Vic Stinger was here, he was talking about this claim by Christians that that the current evolutionary dogmatic theory that science is pushing is really just a conspiracy to prevent them from having to acknowledge that a God exists. When in fact, the way science works, if there was good evidence that a God actually exists, scientists would be falling all over themselves to go and study this new area,
golden age,
where there's shit tons of money.
Yeah.
Because the day that anybody, and hey, Ray Comfort, if you're listening, since you had promised to scientifically prove that God exists without appealing to faith in the Bible, and oh, you're a liar, if in fact you ever had, or if anybody ever does, scientifically demonstrate that a God exists, everything we know about the world begins to change.
Nobel Prize,
lots of funding, whole new areas of research and grants, and we begin to rethink and rework the universe. And if you think people, scientists, aren't willing and eager to do that kind of thing, you don't have a clue what you're talking about. But we knew that already.
Yeah.
What else you got?
Well, I got an old piece of mail that should have been read before.
Uh-oh.
Says, I'm a contractor for the government working on Army aircraft in Iraq. I've been here a little over 10 months, and I've only recently become an out-of-the-closet atheist. This is Harold writing from Iraq.
We got a lot of vets, current Army and stuff.
No, there's no atheists in foxholes.
Right. He says, well, he does say, the resources available to research and learn about atheism is very limited, but I have learned a great deal through your podcasts. Both the Atheist Experience and the nonprofits have been an invaluable tool for me to learn and understand more about atheists and myself.
It's not invaluable. We'll take donations of any size.
I get a lot of dumbfounded stares when I start talking about my atheism over here. Most people can't believe that a person would shun Christianity in this place, away from home, surrounded by Christians, and I guess Muslims. If this makes it on the air, I just want other atheists and agnostics to know that they are not alone, and they can email me anytime they need to talk to someone other than the chaplains.
Outstanding.
Oh, that's great.
His email address. He gave us his email address here. So,
well, hang on. What I think we'd rather do.
What would we
is
put it
rather
on
than put his email address out to the world, where people
idea.
Like that asshat in California who decided to pester some of our listeners with email. If you're in the military and you're looking for somebody to talk to, on these subjects, email us, nonprofits@atheist-community.org.
Mm-hmm.
If you're emailing us for some other reason or any reason, make sure you put NPR in the title. That way it'll get past spam filters easier. And we'll be happy to give you his email address.
Yeah.
And if you really did want us to just give your email address out to the world, write us back and I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we've had some bad experience because there are some people who look at these programs that we do as a way of kind of spying on the enemy to figure out what we're doing and finding targets and saying, look, these people who are, if you're listening to the nonprofits, you've been deceived by the devil, and it is now my duty as a good Christian man to come and talk to you and email you. And if that means that I have to lie in order to find out who you are, misrepresent myself, that's all fine, because it's all for the glory of Jesus.
Right. Yeah. Oh, we don't do that.
Well said.
He has one thing at the end.
Persona.
Yeah.
Asshat. So.
Hey, we've said asshat a few times. If you're listening and you're drunk, it's not our fault. You chose to play the drinking game.
Yep.
Although only chose it through unbreakable natural processes and not of any free will.
So, even though we don't have many details on this, it's been publicized enough that I think we definitely want to talk about it. It's right now, we've got maybe 15 minutes left, but we can go over if we need to.
Sure.
And all I'm going to say is one name.
Uh-oh.
And I imagine Russell's ready to jump all over it.
Oh, yeah?
And the name is...
What should that be?
Ken Ham.
Oh. How do you know Ken Ham did anything? Were you there?
Didn't he spend a lot of money recently?
He spent $27 million building a creationist museum in Kentucky. Scientists have come out in opposition to this.
I gotta say, I saw the photo of the diorama with Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
It looks cool. I mean,
I know.
I hear he hired like a bunch of like Disney people to do you know, professional animatronics.
The dinosaurs are good.
You give me $27 million. Yeah. $27 million. I can come up with a free thought museum with animatronic representations of Ingersoll and Bertrand Russell and all of these other people, and it'll look fucking dynamite.
Yeah,
I know.
So I love religious artwork. And architecture and church is beautiful stuff. And it's beautiful because they could hire the best and spare no expense.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that his museum looks good, well, that's not much of a surprise.
And I will say right now that if I were in the neighborhood, I would go to the Creation Museum. And just like we went to church to write about it, and I don't even care that it's putting more money in Ken Ham's pocket.
But it's not only the scientists that are kind of displeased with this. It's also like his backers, aren't they? Aren't there?
There was a schism in the group, the Answers in Genesis group, but I don't have all the details about that. And basically, the U.S. group separated themselves from the Australian group, and who knows what's going on. All I know is that, you know, Ken Ham makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to basically pollute the minds of people. But and I realize that he is. You know, as I said this about Fred Phelps last week, so I'll say this about Ken Ham. I will give him credit for acting on what he believes in. It's just a shame that what he believes is so stupid and false.
And it's unfortunate that he pays all his taxes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he could be sharing a cell with
Kent Hovind.
That's it. Hovind, Haggard, and Ham. It's evangelists that begin with H, which are real problems. Yeah,
Hovind and Haggard and Ham sent a ton of spam.
They got lots of money. It just isn't funny. Anyway,
and now some of them are in the slam.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. But you know, that's what you get with life. The thing about
I apologize for that.
You mentioned that you'd go, and you didn't really care that it was put more money into their pocket.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go out of my way to go.
Yeah. On the one hand, I agree. You know, for example, I know the ACA took a field trip up to Hell House 1 year, and, of course, that's putting money in there. I've gone to events and other things for the purposes of looking at them and reviewing them. I've bought books. I have some of Lee Strobel's books. I have Josh McDowell's books. I have some CDs by Ravi. You know, my parents gave me some I purchased myself. It's because it's an area that I'm interested in. So on the one hand, if I lived in the area, I'd go to the museum in order to get as much information out of it as I could. And I guess I would probably pay. But I think what I'd rather do is go up to the museum and say, I'd rather not support what you do here with funds. And if this really is an evangelistic opportunity, then you should allow me to go through the museum for free. You shouldn't be charging me for the message that you're claiming is freely available to everybody in the world. If you're going to have a creationist museum, and your purpose behind it is to let people know this truth that you've discovered,
news.
Yes. Then charging for it, it should be a donation-based organization. And as soon as you start charging for it, now you're a business. Not that you weren't a business before in your church, it's just that you're able to obscure the business of your church a little better. And I've gone back and forth on the idea of taxing churches, and my current position is tax them into fucking oblivion.
Yeah.
I've been a little more lenient in the past, but...
Well, let me put forth an argument to justify spending money on religious nonsense for their camp value or to study the enemy or whatever. There are so many people probably paying for that stuff who really believe what they're getting. Your donation is probably going to be a drop in the bucket. And if that is not the case, then they're really in trouble, because the people who are just going there to make fun of it are going to go like once. And PZ Myers had some commentary. This may be some more consolation, but you know, Ken Ham's museum got national press attention. It was covered in like every major news organization. Lots of people like ourselves said we would go to see it just to see how awful it is. And yet, even with all that support, the museum on its big opening day got like 4,000 visitors, which is worse than a real museum typically needs to get. In a normal time.
They may just wind up seeing
fewer and fewer visitors and not really becoming a profit.
I think there's some merit there. The problem is that the argument that you started with,
yeah,
that any contribution you make is so insignificant as not to matter. Just me personally, I can't buy that, because let's say, this same argument, my dad used a kind of a rebuttal to this argument early on. My dad wouldn't shop at places that sold pornography, even if he wasn't buying the actual pornography.
Right.
Yeah.
Because every little bit counts, and even though those places managed to survive without his business, there was perhaps an implicit... For him personally, he was violating his own personal ethics by supporting those places.
Right.
Now, I don't share his convictions. I'll happily go into a store that sells porn because I don't have a problem with porn.
Right.
In fact, sometimes deliberately.
Yeah. Anyway, that has nothing to do with what's going on here.
Would you go into a store that sells Bibles?
Yeah.
Yeah, you bet.
You have to.
It's one of those things, you know. I can go into grocery stores, and the grocery store across the street that I tend to go to.
They probably sell The Secret in their.
They probably sell The Secret in their book stand, and I know that they sell a whole bunch of those really obnoxious looking religious candles with saints and stuff on them.
Oh boy.
That you know, Catholics are loading up a nightstand, you know, practicing their own version of The Secret.
Mm-hmm.
Let me light a candle to Saint, you know, Joe Piscopo.
Now,
and
baby, down just a little.
But
Pesci.
So,
Joe Piscopo.
Carlin prays to Pesci. I pray to Piscopo. But you know, I don't know that that's a good enough kind of justification. I think I might go ahead and pay the fee.
Well, see, my perspective is there are two, I think, opposite ways to beat something. Something that relies on popularity to get its point across. One way is to starve it of funds, which I guess is what you're suggesting. It's just basically, you know, everybody boycott these products,
right.
Everybody refuse to watch these shows, and eventually they'll be starved. But there are some things that are already popular with a large segment of the population, so that your attempting to starve it isn't going to have as much of an impact because of all these people who are getting into it on purpose. I mean, you know, getting into it in all seriousness and like their message. So that's when you go with tactic number two, which is you do as much as you can to hold it up to the light and ridicule it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in a way, this is very much the trajectory that responses to the creationist movement have taken, because for the most part, scientists have in the past been tempted to ignore it and say, this is a bunch of cranks, we don't want to give them legitimacy, if we ignore it, they'll go away. How well did that work?
Oh, yeah.
So, instead of doing that, you know, they say, okay, let's give them the attention they want. They may not be real happy about that when they see what we're going to say about them.
Dover.
Yeah, I think that.
And
that's why I definitely agree, and I'd like to go in the museum just to find out what's there for the purpose of pointing it out on the show and pointing out all the flaws.
Is,
a lot of people
it's possible
have
to use your 20 to give them your $20, but then write.
$20? That's what that place called?
No, I'm just hypothetical.
We don't know.
I just threw out something. Okay, $5. It's possible you could give them your $5 and then do more than $5 worth of publicity damage to them, which you couldn't have done.
You gave Ken Ham $3.50?
Yeah.
I remember that.
I don't. What's that?
It's from a South Park. You gave that monster $3.50? $3.50? Anyway, I'm way sidetracked. Did you have one last bit that you were wanting to do?
No.
Nothing.
I'm done.
Russell,
I
you've
wanna
been
say,
absent.
Appearances to the contrary, I am still on hiatus. This has been a light work month for me because my summer class is just starting. I've made good progress on my thesis already, but it's only going to get worse from here. So I want to show up sporadically when I can, but don't count on it.
All right.
But you guys just keep doing the great job that I know you'll always keep doing.
Oh. Yeah. So we start with self-praise, and we're going to end with self-praise as well.
Sounds good.
And I was surprised when Russell showed up and very pleased. So
cool.
It's one of the things is that
before the show started.
You know, when Dennis and I end up doing the show by ourselves, I don't have any huge objections. I think we do, you know, I'm not very good at analyzing the work that I do myself, but I think we do a decent job.
Yeah.
But there has been concern about whether we bring in a third voice or not, because
don't hesitate if you find something
good. I like the notion of three voices, three different brains working in concert.
Yeah.
Seems like a good
seems
number.
A comfortable number.
Yeah. Four often got in the way.
Yeah.
And so, but on those occasions, sometimes four was great too. So,
oh yeah.
So Jeff,
they're all on the line.
It's been a few months now. You don't have to do the whole year if you don't want to. No, we all know what's going on with Jeff.
Yeah.
And
all right.
Thanks everybody for tuning in. I know Russell. Dennis
against
is going to
all the odds
against
you listen to this show. And against all probability, we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Do you have the date?
No, I don't. I didn't put it down. What is the date in 2 weeks? We have a calendar.
This year is
Can
good
we
radio.
Count?
If this is dead air radio right
yes,
here.
Right
we're
here.
Trying. We should have wound the show up about 3 or 4 minutes ago rather than looking for just. Let me just say one more thing. Today is June 2nd. The next show will be the 16th.
All right.
Saturday the 16th. We'll be live again from 2 o'clock till 3:30-ish Central. And the chat room's open, and we'll look for other people in there.
Yeah. All right. That's
bye.
It. We'll see y'all later.